Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I am back. I am prepping within days of going up and over to Nepal en route to Mount Everest. I'm very jacked up about that. And I want everybody, if you're interested, to go on to my website, www.markpattisonnfl. And there's a tab called Everest Blog. And two things, you can see as much as I will be able to do to give updated what's going on the mountain. And the other part is a really cool Garmin app, InReach Mini series, that it actually tracks me going up and down the mountain. You can see my every move as I try to get to the top safely and back down on the other end. So again, if you want to check that out, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And of course, we always love ratings and reviews. It helps to elevate the game, the awareness, and the inspiration to all these different really great and amazing people that I have on the pod. Okay, so today I want to introduce my guest, Alan Arnett. And Alan is a guy I had on about 50 episodes ago, it seems like. And he's a very accomplished mountaineer, number one. Number two, he has been on so many of the most amazing mountains around the world, including Mount Everest, I believe four times, of which he summited his fourth time, ran into other issues three times prior to that, has been on other big mountains like K2, has climbed with the guy I'll be climbing with, Garrett Madison, and he has a really, really outstanding blog that is super informative. So first, Alan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back, Mark. Thanks.
Yeah. Listen, you were fantastic the first time I talked to you, and I have secretly stalked you ever since because of the great information. And just so I get this out in front, what is the name of your website where you keep this great data, really historical data and all this different stuff around the world?
Yeah, it's just my name, alanarnett.com.
That's great.
A-L-A-N-A-R-N-E-T-T-E.com.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you. So, and we'll go back to that again at the end of this pod. So, you know, I'm in the process right now. So I'm going to give out the date. The date that this podcast is actually being aired is a date in the future. It's before I leave, which is March 31st. I'll have to figure that out exactly when we'll plug this in. But I'm sitting here talking to you on the 4th of March, okay? And a lot of this, I'm tapping into your expertise. I'm busy packing. I've got this 4-page laundry list of all the different things I need on the mountain. And I think the wild card into this year, which makes it unique from any other time, I think, that I can remember in history, is that we've got this awful virus that's out spreading around the world called coronavirus. And the other day when I was sitting back, it really captured my attention on something that you had written because of all the cancellations, not just conferences and meetings and going to the grocery store and going to sporting events, but also many of the different climbers. So I want to start with that in terms of, let's just deal with it. Let's talk about coronavirus and what you're seeing out there right now.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's obviously a global tragedy with getting close to 100,000 cases and close to over 3,000 people have lost their lives to this disease. So it's certainly not something to ignore or to make light of. There was a similar experience back in 2002 with the SARS virus. It was a similar upper respiratory virus, and just so happened that I did go to Everest in 2002. That was my first time, and it was smack dab in the middle of the SARS. And I remember, you know, walking through the airports. I think I connected through Bangkok, and you know, and having my temperature taken and an infrared scan of my face to see if I had fever or not. Wow. So, you know, I guess there is a precedent for this. In that year, nothing really happened at base camp, which is certainly what we hope will happen this year. But the concern, Mark, that I think everybody should have that's going to Everest, and we'll just stay focused on the very narrow area of Everest relative to this virus, is that, you know, base camp on both sides is a very intimate environment. And then the camp itself, Garrett Madison runs an outstanding base camp. So I have no doubt that, you know, things like hygiene and all of that will be doubled and tripled up in terms of washing hands and washing dishes and those type of things. But all it takes is one person to, you know, to get sick. It was 3 years ago that the common flu had an outbreak on the Nepal side, and practically everybody at camp got that. And it actually took out a number of climbers that year.
Wow.
So this stuff is, you know, this stuff does happen. And it's an environment where diseases spread very, very quickly. So if one person comes in that has it, you know, it could take out everybody at camp. By taking out, I mean, in the season, everybody have to go home.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not, yeah, no, that, I mean, obviously that's not what I want. That's not what anybody wants. When we go over there, one of the things, I mean, I don't know how you characterize this. I started to call this a benefit, but certainly never at the cost of somebody else. But many people live by fear. And the reality is that 350,000 to 400,000 people die every year of the flu from influenza. And you know, so we're still haven't reached, you know, those types of numbers. But I think it's just the unknown that's out there. And for me personally, I'm not going to play that game. I 100% going, no turning back. But one of the things that you'd written in your post the other day was that I'm not sure if it's the north side, the China controlled side, but lots of expedition parties and climbers, they're now seeing cancellations, which just means less people, less traffic on the mountain.
Yeah, so it looks like when in my survey of the various operators that the so-called foreign operators or the Western operators like Adventure Consultants out of New Zealand or Garrett Madison out of the U.S., International Mountain Guides, that class, they're not currently seeing Alpenglow. They're not seeing any cancellations, but apparently the Nepali companies who tend to cater more to the Eastern clients in Japan, Korea, China, India, they are seeing some pretty strong cancellations. And as a result, I was forecasting this year that we were going to see over 1,000 total summits. Last year, we approached that. We were in the 970 range on both sides, all routes, all people. This year, I think it's going to be half of what it was last year. I think we're looking more at like 600. The number of permits, I think, are going to be on the Chinese side cut in half. I only think we're going to see about 50 members and then an additional 50 support people. So maybe 100 total on the Tibet side. And on the Nepal side, instead of the normal 1,000 that's at base camp, I think that this year we'll probably see close to maybe 500 or 600, which translates into maybe 250, maybe 300 at the most that'll summit. And that's compared to the 600, over 600 that summited last year. So, you know, from that perspective, you know, people have been talking about the commercialization and how crowded the mountain is and how many inexperienced people are there. And, you know, I don't know, maybe this is Mother Nature or the universe helping us correct a situation that we won't correct ourselves.
Yeah. So last year, so let's dive into that. So when this is 2019, last year in January, I was down in Antarctica climbing, and my tent mate was Don Cash. Mm-hmm. And I've brought this story up, you know, many times. And Don, you know, when we were down there, a great guy, big family, Mormon family out of Salt Lake City. And he just seemed like he was more about wearing the t-shirt and doing, you know, he had this do epic shit saying that he was always talking about and wearing this t-shirt. And, you know, and I've said many times on this show that, you know, and these aren't just words, this is real, you know, real stuff, which is, I just love the process. I love being in the mountains. I know you do too, because I see posts all the time. You're marching all over the Rocky Mountains there in Colorado. And, you know, same thing here in Sun Valley. And I just didn't get that same feeling. And you could see the way he climbed. And again, I'm not trying to pick on him, but, you know, what it really got down to, it was a person who took 19 hours to get to the top. I was tracking him on his Garmin inReach Mini that he had. And, you know, he got to the top, raised his hand, and fell over. And what also came out of that was these low-cost operators that you were just mentioning. And so I don't know. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, it's a benefit. But, you know, really trying to cut back on the people who just, at the end of the day, should not be there, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, the phrase I've been using. I've been talking about this and writing about this for ever since really 2014. And that's when we saw an inflection point where the majority of the people that were guided on Everest were guided by Nepali-owned companies. Prior to that, the majority were guided by the foreign company, the Western companies. And what happened was that in 2012 on Manaslu, there was an avalanche and it killed over 10 Sherpas. And then in 14, of course, there was the Serac release off the west shoulder of Everest, and that killed 8 to 16 Sherpas in the icefall. And so the Sherpas began to say, look, you know, if we're going to be here risking our lives and working for the man, then let's cut out the middleman because we have as much experience as they do now, which was not an incorrect statement. If you go back to Hall and Ball back in the early 90s with Adventure Consultants, it was Gary and Rob that were fixing ropes along with a couple of Sherpas like Andorje Sherpa. But now you've got the Sherpas that they're running Everest basically, and we've always been the guest in their country, and now they're just taking over and running it. So now it's 80% of the clients are guided by these Nepali companies, and they've cut out the middleman, they've cut out the Western guides. So as a result, they're competing primarily on price because their cost structure is so much low, and as a result, that's attracting a new class of clientele, people that don't have the experience, and they are going for the t-shirt in many cases.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that it's not about the Sherpa Nepalese guides and support. It's really about, since they're offering such low money, it's attracting people who really shouldn't be on the mountain. Right.
Yeah, I've got a friend that flies for one of the low-cost airlines, and he compares it to, you know, that the people that get on his airplane, half the time they've never flown before. So when, you know, they actually have to pay attention to fasten your seatbelt, where those of us that traveled for a living for all of our lives, you know, we ignore the safety briefing. So it's the same thing, you know, that people that are on the mountain, one of the other problems is that there's an arrogance associated with it, because the press has for years, especially after Into Thin Air came out in, you know, in the late 90s, just demonized the mountain. They think it's so easy to go up and down it. There's a, you know, there's a McDonald's at the top, there's a Starbucks at Camp 2, and on and on and on. And so you read that anybody can summit Everest, and, you know, anybody can go. You pay your, typically the line I always read is you pay your $65,000 and a Sherpa hauls your ass to the top.
Yeah.
So, and that's just, I mean, it couldn't be further from the truth as evidenced by last year when 11 people lost their lives.
Yeah. Incredible. You know, I will put in about 500,000, literally 500,000 vertical feet between coming off of Vinson, living here in Sun Valley and having mountains across the street to run up and down every single day. And, you know, it just brings me joy and happiness. And when I don't do it, I feel like I've left something, you know, at the table. I haven't done enough work. And I know at some point in time, and this has happened to you numerous times up on Everest, where you've just run into a wall and things will happen. I will run into a wall. And so my whole thing is all about, you know, what can I do to best position myself, to put myself in the best place to, you know, survive and make it through that tough point.
Yeah, Mark, I think you know that I had this consulting business called Summit Coach, where I consult with people. I don't sell any products, it's just information based upon an experience about how to prepare and go and what to expect. And one of the first things I spend time with a new client on is what is their motivation? And we talk about that exact point you just raised, hitting the wall. It's mile 23 in the marathon. Yeah. And when you're up there at 3 o'clock in the morning, going up the triangular face to the balcony from the South Col, and it's 20 degrees below zero and the wind's gusting to 40 miles an hour and you're threading that weather window and every single part of your essence is screaming at you to turn around, but you're going, no, I'm not going to turn around because I have worked so hard to get here and I know I can do this, but every single part of your body is just screaming. Your legs are screaming. Your lungs are screaming. Your heart tells you that keep going, but your mind says turn around. You've got to know what your motivation is. You've got to know your purpose and why you're there. You've got to reflect on that and dig deep and push through that wall to keep going. If is safe. You know, obviously, and that's the reason I turned around three times, because I knew I could go higher, but I didn't know if I could go lower. Yeah. And so you've got to know what the motivation is.
So next question is, let's talk about, you've been on the mountain now a lot. You've been in constant contact with operators all over the world. And I want to start with the guy that I happen to be going with, Madison Mountaineer, and you've climbed with them. Tell me what to expect, Garrett. I've met him actually down in Antarctica last year. I was leading a team he was coming down off that steep fixed line, that ice wall. And I think he looked at me like, you know, who the hell are you? Yeah, I was just a climber. But anyways, tell me with Garrett, you know, I feel like I'm getting the best. One thing that was really important to me as I was evaluating other outfitters that lead expeditions up in the mountain is that I really wanted to be with the lead guy that has been on the mountain and that he's not sitting in a tent on a radio talking to other people that are actually taking those guys up the mountain.
Yeah, so I summited with Garrett K2. I summited K2 with Garrett in 2014, and then I was with him in 2015 on. I was going to do Lhotse, and I was with his Everest team, and that's when the earthquake hit that destroyed our base camp and killed our camp doctor, and you know, and a bunch of other people at base camp, not to mention 9,000 people in Nepal.
Yeah.
So what you can expect from Garrett is a world class guy. Just a consummate gentleman. His attention to detail is outstanding. You know, there's a whole new generation of guides that's now in the industry, in the high altitude mountaineering industry. Mike Hamill is one of them. Garrett is one of them. Ben Jones. But people like Mike and Garrett have spun off from companies like Alpine Ascents and International Mountain Guides to create their own companies. And so they're bringing in innovation, and they're bringing in a different cost structure and different options in order to meet the needs of a growing clientele out there. Is, you know, Garrett is very attuned into good food. You may gain weight on his expedition, which is a rarity these days.
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, you know, he will take this coronavirus very seriously. I spoke with him recently about this, and he says, yeah, they're going to take extra precautions in order, you know, things like double washing all the dishes. They do that anyway, double boil all the water anyway, but they're going to probably double up on that. And you're going to have a hand washing station that's usual, but it's probably going to be, you know, even hotter water than normal. Just, he's going to take every single extra precaution. When you get to base camp, you're going to go through a kind of a boot camp training. You know, you'll recognize that from your NFL days, you know, and you're going to go through practicing walking the ladders before you go up and tying knots and clipping into the fixed rope. And he's going to leave nothing left to chance. His Sherpas are outstanding. He's been working with them for a number of years now under his own company, not to mention his pedigree back with the other companies.
Yep.
So, you know, he's in that new class of guides that's really shaking it up, shaking the old school up.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to climb with him. I have climbed with Mike, I think, 3 or 4 different times, and I really enjoy Mike too. But, you know, I also, one of the things that has become a benefit for me is to mix it up. I've really found value of going with Alpine Ascents the last couple of years and with Mike Hamill before that, then IMG and now with Garrett, you know, so I've really spread out the love around, and, you know, each one seems to attract different people, a different kind of clientele. And I just love learning from different personalities on what they know and how they teach how to, you know, really get around the mountain in a safe way. Yeah. So great news for me, great news for the mountain that we have a guy that really takes it professionally. So let's talk about when, cause I've never done this, right? So I leave on the 31st of March and I land in Kathmandu via a few cities, but give me kind of like from beginning to end, it doesn't have to be every hour by any means, but just like, you know, you land in Kathmandu, what can I expect? Because I know there's a trek just getting up to the mountain, and that takes a bit to do. And then once I'm on the mountain, how that goes.
Well, there's 4 parts to the overall Everest journey, if you will. There's the trip from home to Kathmandu to base camp. So that's number 1. Number 2 are your multiple rotations up and down the mountain or on adjacent peaks like Lobache to get acclimatized. And then the 3rd is your summit push. And your 4th, and the most importantly, is to get back home by way of Kathmandu and getting home. So those are the 4 parts. So you're going to leave, and it'll take you 3 calendar days living in the U.S. to, you know, by the time zones and stuff, get to Kathmandu. You're going to step off of that plane on the tarmac, and it's going to be hot and humid. And you're going to see a monkey sitting on top of the airport. And, you know, all of a sudden you're going to get in this really crowded, you're going to go pick up your duffel bags off of this 1950s carousel. And you're going to send a prayer up in the world and do whatever you do to thank the God for your duffel bag showing up. You know how that was down in Antarctica.
Yeah.
So then you're ended up trekking. It'll take about Garrett typically takes 8 to 10 days to trek between, you'll fly to Lukla, allegedly the most dangerous airport in the world, which is, it's in the top 10, but it's not the most dangerous.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's got a short runway and it just, it dead ends into a mountain wall that, you know, the other end of the runway falls off 5,000 feet. So it is a, it is quite a ride. I think I read somewhere where he may be taking a helicopter this year instead of a fixed wing airplane. Hmm. And that's becoming more and more common. Helicopters are slightly more safe. But anyway, so you go to Lukla and then you're going to begin that trek. And I always tell people, if you ever get a chance to trek, make that trek or the Annapurna Circuit, do it. It will change your life. It is just stunning scenery day after day. You may start off being in snow and a little bit of cold, but as you get closer in to the end of summertime around May 21st, it gets warmer and warmer. But, you know, the scenery, staying in the tea houses, getting exposed to the chortens and the stupas, the kids are unbelievable. Take with you some writing pens and give it to them as gifts instead of money or chocolate, like we used to do when I first went over in 97, because, you know, they need school supplies. So when you see the kids, you know, give them a little, you know, pad and a writing paper or a writing pen. You know, you'll see old ladies spinning prayer wheels and walking along in their crimson robes. You'll see monks. Rhododendrons will be in the bloom as you enter the Sagarmatha National Park. It's just a stunning, stunning experience. And for me, you know, a lot of people talk about they want to avoid that because you get sick. Well, the fact of the matter is that everybody catches some type of, you know, kumbu cough or upper respiratory something. That's just part of the thing. You know, you get it, you get over it. Hopefully you get it early rather than later on. You get over it and you share it with the team. Everybody gets sick. Everybody gets well together. And you keep on going. So the trek in is just a fantastic experience. You'll love it.
You know, I had a buddy call me yesterday, Brian Hart, and his kid doesn't know right now. You've got the kumbu cough. There you go. He's got about a 20-year-old kid that is over. He's been trekking through Nepal, and he was in some temple inside around Kathmandu, and a monkey, like, literally climbed on his back and bit him, and he's got rabies or something now, and so they won't let him out of the country until he goes all through his vaccinations and this process, and then he's stuck there for a couple of weeks. So the last thing I want to do is get, you know, chomped on or attacked by a monkey.
I know a guy that got bit. There's a ton of dogs that they're feral dogs just all over the Kumbu. So, you know, and that's the number rule of thumb is just don't pet the dogs, especially, you know, even though they're cute. And you just want to pick up the little puppy and cuddle it, or the cat, the little kitty in the tea house. But try to avoid touching. You know, this year I'd say avoid touching anything.
Oh, absolutely. Yesterday I went out and I bought a bunch of those surgical rubber, plastic, whatever they are, you know, gloves that I'm just going to keep those on and wash my hands and have those disposable and chuck them out and put a new pair on all the time. I think that's the way to go.
Excellent idea.
Yeah, so I think when you said that you, when you fly in and you're going to land around 89,000 feet and then you're trekking up to advanced base camp, which is around 17,500.
Right, base camp is 17,500.
On the four parts, right, it's going through the Kumba ice field to Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, Camp 4, and Camp 4 is in the death zone at 26,000 plus feet. And then you're from there, that's when you do the summit push up to 29,029 feet. And then obviously, you know, you want to go back down. But for you, what section did you find the most difficult? I know pushing the top is always difficult, but if you just put it in terms of danger, obstacles, you know, physical strength, all that kind of stuff.
Well, the Kumbu icefall obviously has its challenges, and there's a big old hanging serac of just a massive, you know, Empire State Building size on its side wall of ice that's hanging off the west shoulder of Everest, and that thing regularly releases, and that was part of it that released in 2014 that killed all the Sherpas. So you'll see avalanches coming off of that all the time. The other thing is the Kumbu icefall moves 3 feet a day. In the center, it can move up to a meter a day. So you've got this confluence of moving ice along with objective hazards. So the key of getting there is go through that thing as fast as you can. You know, channel your inner marathon runner or speed runner and Kilian Jornet and just go as fast as you possibly can through that section, which means the first time through like 6 or 7 hours. So it's going to be tough. Then, you know, then the Western Kumbh gets really hot. Up the Lhotse face is steep and hard. It's steeper than you think it is. And the first time up, I don't know if what you guys will go. I don't know if you'll do a rotation to Camp 3 or not. But typically, most people go up to Camp 3 and spend a horrible night. But the section for me that was really surprising was when I finally got above the balcony. The first three times, I basically got to the balcony and turned myself around. So I never made it up the Southeast Ridge. So from the South Col, you go up the triangular face to the balcony. There you change out oxygen bottles. And then it's the middle of the night. Typically it's around 1-2 o'clock in the morning if you're on time, maybe 3 at the latest. And you start going up this 45-degree angled rock slab. Typically it's covered in snow, but it all depends upon the year. And crampons on rock is where the difficulty goes up exponentially.
Yeah.
You've got a fixed rope. And, you know, if there's a lot of people, which hopefully there won't be this year, that you can be in this conga line, because people really slow down in that section. And for me, that was a big surprise. Once you make it to the South Summit, these days the Hillary Step is no longer an issue. It's not called the Hillary Slope. But if you can get to the South Summit, then, you know, you're golden to get to the summit. So that Southeast Ridge, to me, that's the crux.
Interesting. Yeah. This summer I was climbing Mount Rainier Jamora and going through the Disappointment Cleaver. That huge rock right in the middle, you know, 12,005. The whole thing was bare. There was not a blade of snow. And we were in our crampons, and it was awful climbing up and over those rocks. And there was a huge line, and it's super crowded. Was not fun to be on.
Well, a couple of people that just finished up unsuccessfully of hitting, I'd hate to use that word unsuccessful when talking about mountains. They didn't summit, so they had a non-summit.
Yeah.
They both turned around primarily due to avalanche danger. One of them on the Lhotse face, the other one was on the West Ridge. And they both talked about it, heavy snow this year. So, you know, we'll see what, you know, you still got another, you know, 6 weeks to go, 2 months before you actually do the summit push. But we'll see what the slabs are like.
Yeah, and so what has been your experience on Lhotse? I know you said you'd signed up to go over with Garrett, and then the earthquake happened, and so obviously you didn't go that year. Did you come back to do it?
Yeah, I tried the next year, and I got some form of upper respiratory problem and ended up cutting it short, not even trying. But I've been underneath where there's a signpost that says turn right for Lhotse as you're going up between the Yellow Band and the Geneva Spur. Actually, it's not a signpost. I'm kidding. But there's a you take a right-hand turn, and you go up. And what most people do these days is they tag Lhotse on top of Everest. So they do Everest first, and they come back down to the South Col, spend the night. The next morning, get up, and they go over. Or they may go over and spend the night at the Lhotse High Camp, which is right above the Yellow Band. A lot of people that do Lhotse talk say it's more technical than Everest is, and that's probably true. At the crux of that climb is like the last 200 or 300 meters, where you get into this very narrow rock fall prone gully. And again, it depends upon the snow conditions. If there's a lot of snow, then it's relatively safe. But there's not a lot of snow, rock fall. I think it was 4 years ago, killed a Sherpa while he was fixing the rope, the fixed line in that area. A rock came down and killed him. Yeah. So, you know, it's very dangerous, a lot of objective dangers. You have to have your technical rock climbing skills honed, because even if you can do a 5.2 at 4,000 feet, you know, trying to do 5.3 at 28,000 feet is a whole different animal.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing is a big animal, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. And that's, you know, it's just a lot of people fear that mountain. And, you know, rather than when I start to look at the whole mountain as a, you know, enormity, it becomes overwhelming for me.
Yeah.
And so I go back a little bit, like when I used to play in the NFL and college football, and I didn't think about the Michigans or the NFL playoff games or something. I just focused on what I needed to do in that moment, in that time. And every single time I would go, you know, right before the kickoff in the locker room, I'd get butterflies. Every single mountain I've been on, I get butterflies before I start in. And then, you know, just like on Denali and some of these other ones, you just take a big deep breath and like, all right, here we are. And just, you know, it's a long, long process. Now, do you think half the battle, one's physical, of course, do you think the other part of that is because you're up there for 2 months is a mental challenge of just trying to stay, you know, not missing everybody back at home and the conveniences of a restaurant and a shower and those types of things?
Yeah, I think there's a mental toughness that's required, and not only in when you hit the wall, as we talked about before, but also just staying focused and not getting sloppy. while you're at base camp, you know, forgetting to wash your hands and, you know, and touching your face way too much and, you know, and shaking hands with strangers and, you know, picking up the puppy. You know, it's just really staying focused and staying true to your mission. And again, coming back to, you know, what's your purpose? Why are you there? And tapping into that. And I also think that I've been on 35 major expeditions around the world, and I never, ever leave home without my satellite phone. Yeah. And so I call friends and family, and that becomes my rock. And I'm not afraid to call up and say, you know, I'm struggling, I need help. And, you know, to get that pep talk from friends. When I hit the top of K2, I was developing pulmonary edema, and I knew I was in trouble. And I called my best climbing friend, Jim Davidson, and had him kind of talk me through it. And at the end, he started yelling at me. I think I told the story before. He started screaming at me, literally. He was saying, "Alan, double check everything. Double check everything." And when I got back home, I asked him, "So why did you tell me that?" He said, "I knew, you know, I was watching your tracker, and I knew you were going slow. I knew I could just tell something wasn't 100%. Yep. So, you know, I thought, what's the one thing I can tell him that is crisp and clear and actionable? So double check everything." And that proved to be prescient, because as I was going down, I screwed up clipping into a rappel device and almost fell to my death. So, you know, is staying focused in that time at base camp is a time to reevaluate where you are, to make sure you're resting, hydrating, eating, you know, staying healthy, just doing everything you can for self-care. Because then once you start moving, you know, it's game on. The clock started, and you can't call a timeout when you're on Everest, especially how much, on summit push.
How much connectivity do you have at Everest Base Camp?
A lot these days. There's something called Everest Link. You know, I would typically budget $200 to $300, and that way I wouldn't worry about, you know, bandwidth and all of that stuff to buy. You know, they measure it by gigabytes, you know, so how much of a gigabyte do you transfer and stuff. You know, and I always took my laptop computer, and I would compress pictures down to smaller sizes, not be sending 10 megabyte, you know, picture files of the dog. Yeah. But it's really good, and you buy your card at base camp. They also have Wi-Fi throughout the Khumbu, but you can't buy the Everest base card, connectivity card, anywhere else other than, actually you can buy it in Namche and you can buy it at base camp.
Yeah, so in terms of doing FaceTime, if I want to interact with other people, that's a way that I could, no?
Yeah, but all those video conferencing use up a lot of bandwidth.
I see.
Audio is not too bad, but the video is really, really big.
Yeah. What is your, as we wrap things up here, what is your biggest advice for anybody, newbie, somebody like me, to, as you know, as I prepare to get out there, what's the one thing that I'm not thinking about that you would only know if you'd actually had experience and you were at Everest?
That's always the question of one, and there's never one. It all depends upon the person. I always tell people that, you know, get your preparation and get your experience, you know, hone your systems at home on your 11,000 foot mountain, you know, your glove systems, your layering systems, your sock strategy, you know, everything, hone that elsewhere, not when you get to the mountain. Everest is not the place to hone your systems and to learn how to tie a figure eight. You know, you do all of that stuff elsewhere. But, you know, when you're there, I think the biggest thing I tell people is really, A, enjoy it. Have fun. I mean, this is an optional thing that you're doing. And go there and have fun. Let the joy permeate your essence. Just knock the ball out of the park. Have fun. You know, celebrate that touchdown. So that's the first thing. The second thing is stay focused. Just don't get sloppy. Don't get lazy. And don't give up. And I guess there's a third thing, and that is, it's hard. It's damn hard. Don't let anybody tell you that is easy, and that because you were a, you know, big sports guy, that for you it'll be easy, or that, you know, for me, because I, you know, I climbed this before, then I can do it. It's hard. It's damn hard. Yeah. And so when you hit that wall, when you realize, you internalize how hard it is, go, oh, yeah, I knew it was hard. I not to name drop, but I met Ed Viesters at a thing he was doing for Big City Mountaineers in Denver. This is 10 years ago. So I was talking to him about Everest, and I said, hey, what about K2? Because this was, I didn't even dream of climbing K2. Yeah. And Peter says, well, let me tell you a quick story. That I'm on K2 and I'm going along. I got my teammate, one of my teammates looks over at me. He goes, Ed, this is really hard. And I looked over, and this is Ed talking. He goes, I looked over at him and I said, you're on K2. What'd you expect?
Yeah, Ed lives up the street here from me in Sun Valley, and I see him around. I've climbed with him on Mount Rainier. He's a heck of a guy, heck of a climber. So it's really, really fun to have not just Ed here, but the Whitaker brothers, especially Lou also has a place here. And I've gotten to know his son, Peter, good guy. And just, you know, it's inspiring being around these different people. Yeah. And yeah, it is hard. But the one thing I do know that the harder that I push, I train twice a day. I go up that mountain, like I said, 500,000 vertical feet that I've climbed since this podcast will have broadcast, you know, doing CrossFit every single morning. You know, I'm doing every single thing I possibly can. I will leave nothing unturned. And that's still going to make it hard, but at least I'm pushing my body to places I really haven't been before. And that I know it's going to be easier than if I didn't do any of those things. I was just on a Stairmaster and I show up.
Yeah, you know, I have a saying that is it hard or is it impossible? And Everest is not impossible. You can certainly do it, but don't expect it to be a cakewalk.
Yeah, no, great advice. And I won't. Always very respectful of the mountains. And, you know, and again, going back to, I think the thing that you really nailed it is that there's a lot of people that are very worried about my safety. And I mean, I absolutely love doing the stuff, right? And if this is the last conversation I have, you know, everybody can know that I had the best time, you know, preparing, going after it. This has been a dream since I was a little kid growing up in Seattle, Washington, all these famous mountaineers up there like Ed, like Lou. And, you know, this is just another challenge. It's another rung. And something tragic that just happened yesterday, as we speak here on March 4th, was a awful tornado in Tennessee. And I think, you know, 20 plus people now have been killed. And, you know, so you start thinking about that and like, hey, I'm going after something I love. And, you know, I'm not going there to die. I'm going up there and I'm preparing myself in a way that's going to hopefully get me to a successful result. And then you can just be walking down the street in Tennessee, in Nashville, and this flipping crazy storm comes through and just starts, you know, like exploding homes and people dying left and right.
You know, what I tell people just like yourself, the last thing I tell people before we hang up a conversation or part ways is that leave nothing left unsaid. When you say goodbye at the airport gate or when you walk out the door to, you know, however you get to leave your home, leave nothing left unsaid to the people that you care about the most in this world.
Yeah, love that. I love that. So let's go back to where we started. Where can people find you and your daily reporting of what's going on, all things Everest?
Yeah, it's on my blog. And again, my website is my name. So it's alanarnett.com. And then there's a big, huge link that'll say Everest 2020 coverage. And then there I have a handful of post already put up, mainly around the virus and some other things. But then I also have a tracking table where I track all the teams on both sides with the, you know, how many climbers there are and where they are at which camp. And I keep that thing updated daily throughout the season. And then as we get into the season, I began to really cover exactly what's happening. I have my own experiences. I've got other sources. I've got moles that send me information from the mountain. So I get confidential stuff that I have to sanitize. And I put it all out there. And I try to be as objective and just as factual as possible. I'm not into sensationalizing anything. I'm very respectful when somebody dies. You probably will not be read about a death first on my website, because I want to make sure that the family had an opportunity to be notified, and on and on and on. It's really a labor of love for me, and I do it primarily to raise money and awareness around Alzheimer's disease, which took my mother. So that's really why I do it, in addition to the love of the mountains.
No, I love that. I started a campaign this year, which I just hit my goal, my financial goal. My daughter has epilepsy, and so it's called Amelia's Everest. And so that was a very fun thing that I had here in Sun Valley, and then I went around. I've been pushing it and finally got her to her summit. She's not, you know, she still has to deal with epilepsy, but I think we're a step closer than we were. And at the end of the day, money creates awareness and hopefully a solution, you know, one day to solve diseases like that and Alzheimer's, you know, for all people. So we're in this fight together. Listen, I will be your correspondent if you'd like on the mountain. I'd love to do that. You can send me text. I think you have my cell number, and you know, any way that I can correspond with you and what's going on, any scoop, and even my personal, we'll call it, you know, struggle that I will enjoy, you know, going through as my labor of love going up and down that mountain. So for that, I thank you and appreciate you being on the pod once again.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
All right, everybody. That's Alan Arnett, the expert on all information and all things Mount Everest. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Owning a home is full of surprises. Some wonderful, some not so much. And when something breaks, it can feel like the whole day unravels. That's why HomeServe exists. For as little as $4.99 a month, you'll always have someone to call. A trusted professional ready to help, bringing peace of mind to 4.5 million homeowners nationwide. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to HomeServe.com. That's HomeServe.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.